The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, while you're turning there, notice that the first second coming was the sixth seal, near the end of a cycle of opening seven different seals. The second instance of the second coming is, in fact, for the seventh trumpet. There is a cycle of angels blowing trumpets, and then the seventh one blows his trumpet in chapter 11, verse 15. The seventh angel sounded his trumpet. So this is the end of the series as well. And there were loud voices in heaven which said, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever." Now, that already sounds like it's the second coming, although there's a sense in which Christ is reigning already now. He's seated at God's right hand. Yet that sounds more comprehensive. But if there's any doubt, you can go on, verse 16, "The 24 elders who were seated on their thrones before God fell on their faces and worshiped God, saying, 'We give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, who is and was, because you have taken your great power and have begun to reign. The nations were angry, and your wrath has come. The time has come for judging the dead.'" See that? And see, that has got to be the second coming, right? "The time when the dead are judged, and for rewarding your servants, the prophets, and your saints," and so on. All right? Now, the third instance of the second coming is in chapter 14, verse 14. Have you found it, all of you? "I looked, and there before me was a white cloud, and seated on the cloud was one like a son of man, with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand." So this is, again, the appearance of the Son of Man in judgment. Then we have, in chapter 15, there begins another one of these groups of seven. This time, seven bowls. That's a little bit unfamiliar figure for us, but it's a common figure in the Old Testament to indicate it's a bowl that is contains wine, usually. And in this case, it's the bowl that contains the wine of God's wrath to make the nations drunk and to suffer in punishment for their rebellion. So that's the imagery that's behind this. Seven bowls of wrath are poured out on unbelievers. And the seventh bowl, it's more convincing if I point you to chapter 15, verse 1, at the very beginning of the seven bowls. "I saw in heaven another great and marvelous sign, seven angels with seven last plagues, last because with them God's wrath is completed." Okay? That is saying then there's no more execution of wrath after that. God's wrath is completed at the end of the seventh one. So at the end of the seventh one, you expect, again, you're going to have the second coming. Then, turning over to chapter 17 and 18, we have a description of Babylon, the harlot, the prostitute. And her fall is described. And then in chapter 19, verse 7, there is rejoicing over the fall of Babylon, but also the preparation of the bride, who is pure, in opposition to the corruption of the harlot. Verse 7 says, "Let us rejoice and be glad and give him glory, for the wedding of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready." And everyone then agrees that this is then the second coming. And then verse 11 of the same chapter, you have another cycle of judgment, another kind of description. "I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse, whose writer is called Faithful and True. With justice he judges and makes war. Christ appears then again to judge the earth. And then comes chapter 20 with the passage about the millennium. And at the end of the millennium, verse 11, then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. Earth and sky fled from his presence, and there was no place for them. Now, not everyone agrees that this is, again, the second coming. I'm giving myself away a little bit by saying that it is, but I want to remind you the fact that there is disagreement about it. Many people place this 1,000 years after the second coming because of the material in the first part of chapter 20, and we'll have to delay a discussion of that. But you can see that it is another judgment scene, and as a judgment scene, then, it's part of another cycle. Now, the one thing which you might puzzle over a little bit is the fact that this final judgment, I've included the millennium and then the great white throne, but I've gone all the way into chapter 21. There's a reason for that, because I believe this passage of judgment has both a positive and a negative side. The negative side you find mostly in chapter 20, because there is mention of the lake of fire and of the judgment of the dead based on their works. But in chapter 21, there is the positive side. That is the New Jerusalem and the reward which comes to those who have been disciples of Christ. And both of these passages contain at their end a little complimentary note reminding you that there is another side. For instance, at the end of chapter 20, which is mostly the negative side, the punishment side, in verse 15 you have, if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. But the book of life is, you see, itself a reminder that not everyone does get punished. Likewise, chapter 21, which is primarily the positive side, you find at the end of the section in verse 8 a negative note. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and all liars, their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. So I do believe that those two passages are complementary. That is, the last section of chapter 20 and the first part of chapter 21 from verses 1 to verse 8. But then following verse 8, you see that John is moved to a new location to see a completed vision of the New Jerusalem, which now goes beyond the second coming into the new world. All right? So what do we have here? What we have is 7 instances, or 6 possibly, depending on your attitude toward chapter 20. But, of course, it's nice to argue that there are 7. The book of Revelation is full of 7s. 7 instances of the second coming. And then, before those instances, material in the book that leads up to the second coming. But now, by this time, I hope you're asking yourself, why go to the trouble of describing the second coming 7 whole times? Why not get it over once and to be satisfied with it? What is the purpose of doing it 7 whole times? And if the material that leads up to the second coming, if that material is meant to show how history moves forward to the second coming, why do that 7 different times? Well, I think there's an answer. It's not as if you just read the story once and then read it 6 more times, exactly the same words. But what's the difference between these 7? And I've tried to capture that on the bottom of the first page of your outlines, I hope you are looking at. On that part, I've tried to capture what I see as some of the distinctive features of each of these cycles of judgment, I'll call them. There are materials leading up to the second coming as a climax, you see. Judgments leading up to the second coming. What's distinctive about each one? And on the overhead, I'm having a little trouble here. There we go. I've summarized that. I believe there's some progress through the book of Revelation. In the first of these cycles, that's when the seven seals are broken by the Lamb, and as a consequence of the breaking of each of these seals, something happens on earth. In that series, what you see is the commission of God's agents, because with the breaking of the seal, there's a voice from the presence of the throne, from one of the living creatures, and one of God's agents, angelic beings, I believe, is sent out from, commissioned by these four living creatures. What you see then is the commissioning of God's holy war with earth that is in rebellion to him. Now, if you notice very carefully, the effects on earth are not described in so many words. You have to infer. It's just said the rider goes out conquering and to conquer. But you don't have a picture then of this conquest. It's just you have the picture of the rider going out in order to accomplish it. So it's the commission. And the point is focused on the origin of God's triumph in his own throne and authority. The second cycle is the one where the angels blow seven trumpets. And there you see, for the first time, focus on the effect that actually takes place on earth. So God is now prosecuting the war. And in the third cycle, you have some symbolic figures appearing. There's a woman clothed with the sun that stands for the church. There is a great red dragon that stands for Satan. There is a monstrous beast that stands for an antichrist figure, and we'll have to discuss him later. There are these symbolic figures, and it turns out that to each figure is associated a particular history, which I can call a symbolic history, a history of the origin and destination of this symbolic figure. And there are, I believe, seven of them. Now, isn't that interesting? It's not so easy to see that there are seven as it was for the seven seals and the seven trumpets, because they were marked. But once you begin to see a pattern, then I think you can pick out fairly clearly seven symbolic histories. What are those doing? Well, they are showing you the depth of the conflict, because these symbolic figures are meant to get you beneath the surface, to give you, as it were, a God's eye view of underlying forces that are operative in history. And then you have the seven bowls of God's wrath, and there you see effects on the earth once again, but this time with further intensity than was the case with the seven trumpets. Now you see what is happening is, in effect, there is an advance each time. We're getting something new. We're having the story told in a new way. And the focus is more on the second coming and its immediate precursors as we move through the book. So it's not as if we're just going through the same thing in the same way again. If you want some orientation to this, I think, in a sense, this bit of outline that I've given you may well be the most important of all the outlines that are on this handout. There are several of them. It may be the most important for giving you a preliminary orientation. If this is all that you carry away from tonight, that's going to be fine. If you want a way of classifying it, the best way I have is think in terms of the fall of Jericho. And I believe there are quite a few analogies in the book of Revelation that are based on that. The fall of Jericho was a judgment that God executed in history that anticipated that final day of judgment. It was a judgment against unbelief, against the idolatry that Jericho and those cities of Canaan represented, and in favor of God's own people who were with him and accompanied him in his presence in the ark, accompanied him into the land. Now you see, think of that fall of Jericho, all right, and now say, now God is giving us a picture of the destruction of the final city, if you will, the city of the world itself, which Babylon sums up. The city as it represents rebellion against God and selfish pleasure. And now God is executing his holy war against this idolatrous city in its final form. And he sends out his scouts, all right? And that's the first of these cycles. And then the trumpets are blown. It's like the people marching around the city of Jericho, you know, blowing the trumpets. 7 days they marched around, and the seventh day they marched around 7 times. All those sevens there are no accident. But again, it's the symbol for completeness. So now you're marching around the city, and in the third cycle, it's as if you sort of lifted up the rug underneath the city to see the corruption within it. All right, you saw all the hidden dirt that had been swept under the rug to see what issues were really at stake. And in the fourth cycle, the 7 bowls, it's as if you dive bomb the city to soften it up. All right, so there is further action against the city. And by the fifth cycle, the judgment on the city is pronounced. All right, so there the city falls down, if you will. The walls fall down, and it's ready to be plundered. And in the sixth cycle, Christ leads his army, and it's as if you're in hand-to-hand combat then with the inhabitants of this destroyed city. It's the final war. And then the seventh cycle is actual judgment and division of the spoil. All the treasures of the city split up and transformed to be part of the New Jerusalem. So I think if you orient yourself that way, I think some of the parallels are much closer than others, but if you think in terms of the fall of Jericho, you'll be able to keep your bearings as you read through the book and see whether that doesn't help you to understand that there is a logical progress through the book. Now, if you want a quick summary of what is happening, this next diagram, I think, will do the best job. Every one of these cycles is leading up to the second coming. But as you get further through the book, the focus is more on the second coming itself and its immediate precursors. All right? So that by the time you get to the sixth one of these, the white horse judgment, the second coming is right there at the beginning. There's no pause for anything else. All right? So that the later parts of the book are more focused towards that final endpoint. And of course, by the eighth one, where you see the New Jerusalem, you're past the second coming and on to the other side of it. Now I want to look at these cycles individually. Is there anything that we can say about the contents of one of these individual cycles? And the next page of your outline does some of that. We can't get into all the details, and you can study this the next 2 pages, I believe it is. You can look at those on your own. But I want you to see a particular pattern that occurs. And the pattern is this, that these cycles, now near the end things get compressed, but in the first few cycles, this is the way it goes. You have an A part where the scene is introduced and where the person who gives recompense, it's God or it's agents of God in every case, the person who gives the recompense is introduced in the preliminary scene. All right? And then you have a B part where you have a series of 6 judgments. One after the other, that are coming out from the recompensers, that is, those who are executing judgments. And then you have a part which is kind of A prime, that's the way I've labeled it, because it's a little kind of parenthesis. It's as if you'd seen, for instance, these six seals are being opened, all right? That's the first of the series. And as they're opened, judgments take place on the earth. By the end of the sixth seal, the reader is pretty appalled, saying, look at the devastating character of these judgments. What's going to happen to me in all of this? Am I going to succumb to these judgments myself? And so the parenthesis is stuck in to say, this is what will happen to those who belong to God's people, who belong to the church of God. It's a promise, a reassurance, and a call for endurance to us. Now, I think this will help you also. Look, some of these are small little pieces, but they're inserted because these judgments have something relevant to say to us as God's people. There is a promise to the church. The first of these is a whole chapter long, a whole of chapter 7, and it's stuck in there between the sixth seal, which has already been opened at that point, and the seventh seal, which is still waiting to be opened. And then there's a seventh and final judgment, and I've labeled that BB. Really, the B's, you see, go together because they're the judgments, and the A's go together because they show, as it were, the heroes of this drama, or at least God, who is the big hero, and his people, who are the benefactors for it. So the A's go together and the B's go together, but they go together in a different way. The B's are a sixth and then a seventh. And here's how you diagram it. The scene, and then six judgments, and then an intervening promise, and then a seventh judgment. Well, you can follow that pattern out then through the seven seals and the seven trumpets, the seven symbolic histories, and so on down. Now, I would suggest even that there is the same pattern occurs at a larger level when you get to these series of sevens. All right? But the series of sevens are, you have six, and then a break, and then the seventh. And the break, interestingly enough, the little parenthesis of reassurance to the church is the millennial passage. Now, that may also be a clue to helping understand that millennial passage, but again, I don't want to spend all our time on it tonight. I want to show you one more thing before we leave the subject, and that is a different kind of pattern that occurs on top of the patterns we've already looked at. The thing to do here is to feel overwhelmed, as I sometimes do, at the tremendous artistry of the book of Revelation, that this is a book that is woven together in such a striking way, in overlapping ways. And the pattern that I want you to notice, I'm not sure what page it's on. Have people found that? Page 5, okay, near the bottom of the page. The pattern, it's like a pattern in a play. Then in a play, the characters will enter the stage often one by one. The characters on the stage may occasionally mention someone that's not really come on stage yet, that you haven't seen yet. But then eventually you will see that character that may have been mentioned here and there before he comes on. Well, the book of Revelation has these symbolic figures, the beast, the dragon, false prophet, Babylon. Those figures are like characters in this drama, if you will. And they are brought on stage one by one. Occasionally they are mentioned here and there before they're brought on stage. But beginning with chapter 12, they are brought on stage one by one. First, the woman clothed with the sun, standing for the church, in a beautiful creation picture. And then the dragon, Satan, and then the dragon's assistants, the beast and the false prophet, and then the church again, this time introduced with a different symbolism, the symbolism of a virgin, of the purity of the church. That's chapter 14. And then finally, Babylon, the harlot, the prostitute, the negative side, the opposite of the church. All right? Once all the characters are on the scene, then they're taken off one by one in the reverse order that they were brought on, and you are told then what the fate of each one of these characters is, what the destiny is. The first then to be taken off is Babylon, the last that entered, and Babylon, the judgment on Babylon is then announced in chapter 18. After that point, you never hear of Babylon again. She's wiped out forever. All right? And then you have the judgment pronounced on the beast. Really, it's the one beast from the sea and a kind of sidekick or helper who's called the false prophet. So those two go together. They are judged together. That's in chapter 19. Consigned to the lake of fire, and they never stir up any problems after that. Then Satan appears and is judged in he's bound for 1,000 years, then he is released, and then he goes to a final judgment in chapter 20. And then finally you have a reward pronounced on the church. I missed the reward on the virgin church, but there are two reward passages for the church, and one is the virgin imagery of purity, and one is the creation imagery. Now you see, what is happening there is an arrangement there, which is partly a dramatic and artistic arrangement. And there's one other thing to mention, and that is frequently in the center of this sort of pattern will be a very important figure. And of course, Babylon is an important figure to reckon with in the book of Revelation. This pattern, incidentally, where you go, you bring things on in one order and take them off in reverse order, is called a chiasm. And you will find that pattern happening with the symbolic characters. And I believe you will also find it in some other ways with some of the themes of the book of Revelation. And the next two or three pages deal with some of the themes of Revelation and showing you that there are some rather elaborate patterns of that form. The one I have overhead is looking at the pattern of sevens. Once we begin to recognize that there are sevens in the book of Revelation, can we see a further organization? I believe, yes, we can. Some of the patterns are more doubtful. For instance, the seven last things. Well, I'm not so sure that I've got that right, but I think we can, if we're willing to admit that some of the things are less clear than others, then we can relax about some of the things that are less clear. Now, where do we go with all this? Well, I believe the major point is simply that we grasp that this book is carefully organized and that we see that some of the concern is actually a dramatic concern, a concern to involve you in a story, and not simply, not wholly a concern just for chronology, just for when one thing happens and another thing happens. Some people, I believe, get into a mistake because they assume everything must be in straight line chronological order. Well, that's not true in the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel does the same kind of thing. The same story is told in chapter 2, chapter 7, chapter 9, chapter 10 and 11 in Daniel. So you get in Daniel a similar kind of cycling back and saying, well, now let's tell the story again and show you something else about it. I wish we had time for some questions this time because I've covered a lot of ground, but I hope I haven't exhausted you. We've gone almost a full hour. Let's have a closing word of prayer, and then we'll have our offering.
The fifth lecture in this series is the Interpretive Principles for Revelation.
I've met many people who, when they hear that I periodically teach in the book of Revelation, they immediately want to know about the millennium. And that's understandable, but in fact, that's not the most important issue for interpreting the book of Revelation. It's important for other reasons, we will talk about that, God willing, in a few weeks. But for the book of Revelation itself, there are other important issues that have to do with our understanding of the book as a whole. The large portion, the more large middle section of the book that is prophetic in nature. And in my summary of the point is, the point we're going to cover tonight is that people have differed in the past over their interpretation of the book of Revelation, and they've differed for a very good reason, namely, that the symbols and pictures in the book of Revelation are multifaceted. I think they are deliberately designed to have multiple applications, to have multiple bearings on us. And so we can learn, I think, from what people have done in the past with this book. But now I want us to take a little time to look at what the major ways that the book has been interpreted. Most of these ways are still around. Over the radio and other places, you will hear representatives of four, no less than four different viewpoints. Now, how do these viewpoints differ from one another? Well, they differ primarily in terms of where they think the major parts of the book of Revelation, this major center section, when that section is fulfilled. It's the dating that makes the difference between these four different positions. And now I want to single out these positions, tell you what they are one at a time, and then we'll talk about what they have to say for themselves, which one or which ones we should ourselves follow. The first of these viewpoints, this chart is a little bit out of order because the first of the viewpoints is the second one on this chart. The first viewpoint is generally called preterist, but that's a rather obscure name for it, and I prefer to call this point of view the Roman Empire point of view. And the reason is a very simple one, namely, and I'm going to quote from some interpreters and their own definitions of it. Beckwith says that this interpretation sees the chief prophecies of the book as fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem and the fall of the Roman Empire. All right? So I call this the Roman Empire view because the fulfillment of the major bulk of the book of Revelation comes right back here on a timeline where this is the first coming of Christ and this is the second coming. It's right back near the beginning, the first centuries of the church. Kenneth Strand says that it's one that attributes fulfillment of the messages of the book of Revelation almost exclusively to the past, specifically the past of the early church period. Let me give you one example of how that works. There is a beast that rises out of the sea, described in chapter 13. He's a major figure in the whole book of Revelation. Everyone acknowledges that this beast represents he's a symbol for a tremendous, powerful opposition against the people of God, against those who serve Christ. He is a persecutor of Christians. Now, the question we're going to ask of these interpretations is, what do they make of that beast? And in the Roman Empire interpretation, the beast is the Roman Empire, or else one of the emperors of that empire, because that empire persecuted the Christians, including the Christians of the seven churches of Revelation. All right? So that fits with this particular interpretation. The second interpretation is generally called futurist. And I've got another diagram for that one. It's number four here, this one. The futurist interpretation, I'm going to rename that too and call it the second coming interpretation. Why? Because it looks upon the book of Revelation as treating mainly events of the future, not merely John's future, that is the future when it was originally written, but our own future. Or put it another way, that the major bulk of the book of Revelation is concerned with events immediately related to the second coming, immediately preceding the second coming and leading up to it. Now, there's two forms of futurism, one of which sees chapters 1 through 3 is related to the past, and another one which says that they're an outline of the whole of church history. But that minor difference need not concern us. The major thing is that the bulk of the book has to do, from chapters 4 onwards, has to do with the events immediately related to the second coming. All right? Now, what about the beast? What do you suppose people would do who hold this interpretation? The beast, in a second coming interpretation, is the final Antichrist. Now, the word Antichrist is sometimes used. It is used, for instance, in 1 John, of anyone who denies that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. But there is a final figure, the Apostle Paul calls him the man of lawlessness, arising immediately before the second coming, who will be a great opponent, who will be a counterfeit Christ. And the people who interpret the book of Revelation this way will then say, well, the beast is that Antichrist figure. Okay, so that is the second of the interpretations. The third interpretation is usually called historicist or continuous historical. I'm going to call it the church history interpretation. Why? Because this point of view sees the symbols of the Book of Revelation as setting out in broad outline the history of Western Europe and is stretching right on until the second coming of Christ. In this point of view, basically, the early part of the book corresponds to the early part of church history, and the later part of the book corresponds to later and later parts of church history. Now, if you take that view, what does the beast represent? Almost all the people who operate in this viewpoint think that the beast stands for the papacy. It stands for the pope, and especially the way in which the papacy and the popes in the past have used their position and authority to suppress the truth of God. Now, we hope and pray that things are changing in our day. But in the past, the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church has sometimes been instrumental in suppressing the reading of the Bible and suppressing the knowledge of the doctrines of justification and of faith in Christ. And in those situations, it became then a persecutor of those who had true faith in God. So you can see why people who think that the Book of Revelation is lining up all these events of church history would line up the beast with the papacy. The fourth interpretation is called idealist, usually. But once again, I'm going to use another word for it. I'm going to call it the repeated pattern interpretation. It's this one here. And this interpretation says that the Book of Revelation is a symbolic portrayal of the spiritual cosmic conflict between the kingdom of God and the powers of satanic evil. It represents, in other words, conflict between God's kingdom and anti-Christian opponents whenever it breaks out in the world. So it's a matter of, again and again, these outbreaks of the patterns which are described in the Book of Revelation. Now, suppose you take that attitude toward the Book of Revelation, what would you do with the figure of the beast? Well, you would say that the beast represents satanic evil wherever it breaks out to oppress the church. So the beast doesn't represent only one figure, doesn't represent only the emperor of Rome, doesn't represent only the pope, but represents, is a pattern wherever satanic oppression breaks out against the church. Now, let me summarize those pictures all together in a single diagram. And I think this will help you to see the relationship between these four points of view. What were they? First of all, the Roman Empire point of view says, if you're reading somewhere in the middle of the Book of Revelation, if you're reading about the beast, try to find something in the Roman Empire which corresponds to that. All right? Second point of view was the Second Coming point of view that says, look at the events immediately preceding the Second Coming, which are still future for us, all right? So it's saying, really, we haven't seen a fulfillment of most of the things that are in the Book of Revelation. Third view was what? The church history point of view. And that said, look, it's fulfilled all the way through the book of the course of church history. The early parts of the book have already been fulfilled, and the later parts haven't. And then the repeated pattern point of view says, these things happen again and again. They represent patterns of the opposition between the kingdom of God and Satan. Okay, so those are the four points of view. And before we try to settle down and ask ourselves which is right, let me give you one more example. Before I do that, I should mention one variation. It's sometimes associated with the repeated pattern point of view. It's called the recapitulationist view. And that means that in the Book of Revelation, the same things are said more than once. The same story is gone through more than once. Now, you can already see, if you were here last Sunday night, that my own interpretation has some similarities to that, because I think that the book leads up to the second coming more than once, you see. And so I'm saying, yeah, the same events are being repeated more than once in the course of the book. But before we try to wrestle with what our own viewpoint should be, let me give you one more example, and this one is a rather colorful one. It concerns the locust plague of chapter 9. If you turn your Bibles to chapter 9, we'll show what has been done with this chapter. Now, I want you to realize that what we're doing here is valuable, because we need to listen and respect what other people have done with not only this part of the Bible, but other parts of the Bible. It's not necessarily true that all Christians are right in their interpretation of the Bible. And we're familiar with differences of interpretation. But any time there is a difference that has been around for a long while, then we have to be careful and say, is there something to learn from other people? Maybe we shouldn't be too quick to leap on the bandwagon just because, say, I tell you, here I am as the speaker for a series, and I tell you this is my opinion, and so everyone believes it. Well, we shouldn't be too quick to do that, particularly on those areas that are controversial. I hope much of what I've said has not been controversial, but this area is. So let's be careful and slow in making up our minds if there are areas where other godly people have disagreed. Well, let's now look at this Revelation 9, and we'll see what's been done with it. The fifth angel sounded his trumpet, and I saw a star that had fallen from the sky to the earth. The star was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. When he opened the abyss, smoke rose from it like the smoke of a gigantic furnace. The sun and sky were darkened by the smoke from the abyss. And out of the smoke, locusts came down upon the earth and were given power like that of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree, but only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were not given power to kill them, but only to torture them for 5 months. And the agony they suffered was like that of a sting of a scorpion when it strikes a man. During those days, men will seek death, but will not find it. They will long to die, but death will elude them. The locusts looked like horses prepared for battle. On their heads they wore something like crowns of gold, and their faces resembled human faces. Their hair was like women's hair, and their teeth were like lions' teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the thundering of many horses and chariots rushing into battle. They had tails and stings like scorpions, and in their tails they had power to torment people for 5 months. They had as king over them the angel of the abyss, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon and in Greek Apollyon. There is a rather elaborate description. What have different interpreters of the book of Revelation done with it? Well, let's start with the Roman Empire point of view. And Summers is a commentator who represents that point of view, and he says of this that it symbolizes the hellish rottenness, the internal decadence in the Roman Empire. And incidentally, if you have a book at home on the book of Revelation, look what it does with the locust plague, and you'll find out right away which of these four categories it belongs to. This is a good acid test for what an interpreter thinks of the whole book of Revelation. So that's the Roman Empire point of view. It's the rottenness of the Roman Empire is depicted here. What about the final crisis or the second coming point of view? Well, in this one, Seiss says this. I just realized I better hold off on this because he's interacting with another point of view. Let me delay on that and take the church history point of view next, all right? And in this one, almost all the interpreters who are operating in this viewpoint think that what is depicted here is the Mohammedan invasion. Now you see, that's what happens when you spread out the book of Revelation over church history, and you locate this somewhere on that timeline, and they locate it at the Mohammedan invasion. And then some of them are quite elaborate about the detailed features here. And you remember the locust had hair like women's hair, and Marrow says, this seems to point clearly to one of the most conspicuous features of the Mohammedan religion, that which allowed in this life unrestrained indulgence of the animal passions of men to the great degradation of womankind, and which promised in paradise the most unlimited delights of sensuousness, unquote. And then the crowns on the locust head. Barnes says, this will agree well with the turban worn by the Arabs or Saracens, and which was quite characteristic of them. And then the breastplates, they have something to say about that, and so on. Well, I don't know what you think about this. I think it's a bit imaginative, but they are quite serious in making these correlations. And even the 5 months, remember the locusts exercise authority for 5 months, and Eliot has that all plotted out. It stands for 150 years, each day of the month for 1 year, beginning in 612 AD, which was the public opening of Muhammad's mission, and ending at 762, which was the removal of the caliphate to Baghdad. So he's really got it down pat, as he thinks. Okay, that is then the church history point of view. The future point of view, the second coming point of view says, and here we'll come back to Seiss, he says now the 5 months must accordingly mean 5 months and not 150 years. And the locusts from the pit cannot be the Saracens, the Arabs, or anything else than what they are literally described to be. They are extraordinary and infernal agents whom Satan is permitted to let loose upon the guilty world as part of the judgment of the great day. Now you see, he is thinking of these things, we're to expect it literally had to happen in the future. And then he says also, and we do greatly mistreat the records which God has given for our learning, if we allow the skeptical rationalizing of our own darkened hearts to persuade us that such supernatural things are impossible and therefore must not be literally understood. Well, I think you must respect Seiss's zeal there, though I think it's misplaced, because it isn't only people who are skeptics who may believe that this is not intended to be literal, any more than the beast is intended to be literal. The beast is a symbol, is it not, of anti-Christian opposition. And so John Walvoord says that this picture here of the locust is a visual representation of the hordes of demons loosed upon the earth in this final crisis. So he himself, though he thinks it's still to come, doesn't take the picture as completely literal. So that's the futurist one. Now what about the idealist, or what should I say, the repeated pattern point of view? Hendrickson says this, under the symbol of a locust plague, John describes the powers and influences of hell operating in the hearts and lives of wicked men. Can you conceive of a more frightful and horrible and true picture of the operation of the powers of darkness in the soul of the wicked during this present age? Now that last phrase, during this present age, is the dead giveaway, you see, that he thinks that is a repeated pattern. It's true of all wicked people, that picture is characteristic of them. I want to read you one further commentator, and I hope this helps. It's Albertus Peters. And he says this, if you ask me what all this means and expect that I should be able to point to something in history that corresponds to the burning mountain cast into the sea, to the falling star called Wormwood, to the locust from the pit, or to the terrible cavalry rushing up from beyond Euphrates, I cannot answer. I am sorry to disappoint my readers, and sorry to appear so ignorant, but really, I do not know what these things mean. That's someone who wrote a commentary on the book of Revelation. Well, some of you may feel as if you're in that category. But now, can we stand back a little bit from these positions and ask, why are people taking them, and what are the strong features of the positions? And I'll take them one at a time. First of all, the Roman Empire viewpoint. Its strong point is in appreciating that God was interested in writing to those seven churches back there in the first century. He had something to say to them, a message of comfort, of challenge, of rebuke, and the whole book of Revelation was relevant to them. And so this approach attempts to wrestle with what it meant to those original people that God was concerned for. Well, what about the second coming point of view? That point of view notices a complementary truth about the book of Revelation, namely that the big hope of the book is in the second coming of Jesus Christ. And that is what everything builds up to. And so naturally, they think of the rest of the book, you see, as occupied with the immediate precursors to that event. Now, the church history point of view, you could say, I guess I'm not quite so sympathetic, if you want to know the truth, for this point of view. But the best you could say for it is that it's as if they stood and they said, yes, indeed, I can see that the book starts with the Roman Empire, that is concerned for those seven churches, and I can see that it ends with the second coming. So somehow or other, I have to stretch out the body of the book between those two endpoints, you see, and plot it out in between. And I think that's, in large measure, what has led to that particular kind of interpretation. And then the repeated pattern approach, the people in that group basically say, well, look at the confusion that's been generated by these three different alternatives. And the reason why those three alternatives look attractive is because, in fact, there is a repeated pattern. It's a pattern that occurs here, and that occurs here, and that occurs here, and that each of these three points of view are essentially seeing what their eyes are open to see, because the pattern is a repeated pattern. Now, I also want to give you some comfort here, and that is that I think, in one sense, that these four points of view are not quite so far apart as you might think at first. For instance, if you're reading somebody who is in the Roman Empire point of view, then there's always the option of saying, yes, indeed, the book of Revelation is mainly about this situation. But this situation was, in some sense, a foreshadowing of what will happen just before the second coming. So one could begin to say there are things that are relevant for this point also. Or you could say, even though it's primarily fulfilled right here, yet there are general principles which are operative all the way through. You see, and so you could begin to move away from just being in one of these camps, if you will, just being in one of these positions and say, yes, I think there's a bit of truth in the other points of view. Or if you started here and you said, I think this is just about the eternal conflict between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of Satan, then you could start moving away from that and say, well, yes, I think that there is a particularly intense or particularly focused example of that in the Roman Empire. And because John was writing to those seven churches in the Roman Empire period, naturally he used things which related to their immediate circumstances. So you could begin to say, well, there's a repeated pattern, but it breaks out particularly intensively at the last or final crisis. Let me tell you at this point the way I'm going to go and then try to indicate some of the reasons why we can go that way. I want to do a kind of combination of these four points of view, and I've already hinted at that, I think, of saying when you have a symbol in the book of Revelation, think of the locusts, or think of the beast. Those locusts do represent a general principle. And I think every one of these interpreters and the locusts knew that these were some affliction that came on the wicked. They all recognized that it was a horrible, monstrous sort of oppression and torture that came on the wicked. They all recognized that that was the general meaning of the symbol. Where they differed was to say, well, just when and where is that fulfilled? And I want to say, yes, there is a general principle, and in fact, there's the possibility of three special points at which that general principle is fulfilled with particular intensity. One will be in the Roman Empire, the reason being God was concerned for those people back there, and he did write with them in mind. All right? And so we can agree to a certain extent with interpretation that says, yes, that is indicating the hellish rottenness that is behind this Roman Empire that is persecuting Christians. And then there is a special embodiment in the final crisis related to the Second Coming. Why? Well, without going into the details, it's as if this struggle between God and Satan breaks out with a particular intensity at the times of crisis. It did at the first coming of Christ. The demons came out into the open and they resisted Christ's work at that point. And we can expect, just preceding the Second Coming, a special outbreak of wickedness, the man of lawlessness, often called the Antichrist. All right? Now, the third area of embodiment, I would suggest, is right now. Not because the time we're living in is by itself necessarily something special. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. That's not our business so much to decide whether our time is special. But the fact is, this is where we are. And the Lord wants us to apply his word to our own lives and to our own situation. Now, he doesn't necessarily guarantee that we will have enough information to know exactly how the book of Revelation was to be applied back there to those seven churches. Well, we can know in a general way, but not exactly. Or we might not have enough information. It's even harder because it's still future. We might not have enough information to know how it's to be applied in some future time. But he does guarantee that we'll have enough information to know how to apply it now, because that's our responsibility. Now, when we talk about next week, when we talk about the dragon and the beast and so on, we will begin to wrestle with the meaning of the book of Revelation for now. For the time being, I want you just to rest with that particular picture and to say you can learn something from interpreters who are going at the book in more than one way. You can learn something about the principles if you listen to them carefully, whether or not they see those principles as embodied primarily in the past or primarily in the future. The principles are still valuable for your life. So, in a sense, I want to comfort you by saying you don't have to be concerned to make up your mind right away which one of these points of view is right. You can apply the book of Revelation now in terms of watching for those principles, the beast representing satanic opposition, wherever it occurs. You can apply it to your lives now, whether or not the primary fulfillment is at one point or another in history. So I think that can give us help, those of us who are not experts particularly, to have a little bit of breathing room and not to have to make up our minds about everything right away. Now, one of the reasons why I'm in that position is that it's because of an attitude that I take, and I would urge you to take, towards the symbolism of the book of Revelation. Now, many people come to the book of Revelation as if the book is a kind of code, where for every symbol there is some meaning, all right? And the second symbol with a second meaning, and the third symbol with a third meaning. And the way they go about looking at the book is essentially, my job is to decode these symbols one by one. And once I've got them decoded, once I know what they mean, then essentially I can throw away the book in its symbolic form and have left what's the important part, namely these decoded messages. Now, I would suggest that it's not that easy, that the symbolism is really more powerful than that, that it's a little bit more like poetry, where in poetry you have symbols, to be sure, separate ones, but they're woven together. They function as wholes. If you were here the night when we looked at the vision of God on his throne, I hope you began to realize that the profundity of that vision we grasp only if we see the large picture, and we don't just get our eyes focused on one particular detail in isolation from the whole. We've got to have a large vision of how the different details function to make a whole picture. The locust plague, don't get bogged down in what does the sting represent, or what does the 5 months represent, or what do the crowns on the heads represent, before you felt the impact of the whole picture, which is a picture of a monster, basically. It's a picture that is meant to give us, to make us appalled at the sufferings that are going to come on those who are not sealed by the Lamb. It's a frightful picture. These are monsters that are being pictured. And in a sense, that's the main point. And the details can be fit into that once you have the main point, but the whole picture functions as a whole and have left what's the important part, namely these decoded messages. Now, I would suggest that it's not that easy, that the symbolism is really more powerful than that, that it's a little bit more like poetry, where in poetry you have symbols, to be sure, separate ones, but they're woven together. They function as wholes. If you were here the night when we looked at the vision of God on his throne, I hope you began to realize that the profundity of that vision we grasp only if we see the large picture, and we don't just get our eyes focused on one particular detail in isolation from the whole. We've got to have a large vision of how the different details function to make a whole picture. The locust plague, don't get bogged down in what does the sting represent, or what does the 5 months represent, or what do the crowns on the heads represent, before you felt the impact of the whole picture, which is a picture of a monster, basically. It's a picture that is meant to give us, to make us appalled at the sufferings that are going to come on those who are not sealed by the Lamb. It's a frightful picture. These are monsters that are being pictured. And in a sense, that's the main point. And the details can be fit into that once you have the main point, but the whole picture functions as a whole, and there can be correspondences with particular fulfillments in history, but that doesn't always exhaust the picture. Let me give you another picture, very briefly. Remember, a couple of weeks ago, I think I had this picture overhead to show you that when Jesus was giving prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem, it may very well have had a double reference. And much of prophecy may even have as many as four different references. All right? A reference to the prophet's own time in the Old Testament, a reference to restoration within the bounds of the Old Testament still, a reference to the first coming of Christ, and a reference to the second coming of Christ. Now, the fact is that I think sometimes symbolism, sometimes poetry, is more capable of having that multifaceted reference than if we just had a newspaper description. And the book of Revelation, in effect, has the potential to be applied to you and to be applied to those seven churches way back in the first century, and to be applied to a final crisis precisely because it is put in the symbolic language. So we have got we've got two things together. We've got, on the one hand, some real challenges, some things that are difficult. Many of us would have liked it if the book of Revelation was more like our daily newspaper. And it isn't. It's full of symbols. That makes it hard. But I think also there's a positive value to that. It's the value of having symbolism that can be multifaceted. That picture of the locusts, it can both impress you with the monstrous character of evil, and it can relate backwards to a prophecy way back in Joel chapter 2, where there was a prophecy of a locust plague there, which prefigured the day of the Lord. And that prophecy back there also was depicted as if the locusts were like an army. And it seems to me that that army imagery made the people capable of relating what Joel was saying also to the experience when the Babylonian army came in and virtually wiped out the people of God, took them into exile. Now, what am I saying? I don't want us, we don't have time to look at the locust plague in detail, but I want you to begin to see that this symbolism is capable of multiple application precisely because of its symbolic character. I think the closest thing we have in our day to something like the Book of Revelation is our political cartoons. Now, political cartoons aren't always very funny. They're often quite serious. But they use symbols. Symbols like elephants and donkeys and bears and things. But we understand those symbols, because we're living in a time, of course, where they have become conventional. But also, the pictures are capable of saying things sometimes much more colorfully, much more forcefully, than they could necessarily be said just by writing words on a page. And the Book of Revelation is something like that. Well, that's right, yes. I think the sixth seal, where you remember there is, if you open to that, it's in Revelation 6, 12. The sixth seal represents the breaking up of the heavens and the earth itself. And there's seven calamities on nature, seven groups of men affected, and the wrath of the day, it's the day of the wrath of the Lamb. So I believe that's the second coming. And then the question is, what about the seventh seal? There's nothing left after that. So what is the seventh seal? Well, some people, the seventh seal is in chapter 8, verse 1. When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And some people say, well, that silence is a blank, and it's filled by the trumpet sequence. But I think that's really, it's a modern idea. It's a 20th century idea. It's not an idea that was common in the first century. In the first century, you find outside of the Bible, admittedly, some other writings that are speculative type writings that speak of the silence of both the original creation, and the day when God started to create, there was silence, and then the silence when he recreates. And I believe what's happening is that's what you're getting is the silence of recreation. After the second coming, what comes? New heavens and new earth. And you're giving the silence, which is, as it were, the prelude to that final act. But for dramatic reasons, the Lord God himself and John, the human author, doesn't want to introduce that vision quite yet. It's too climactic a vision. So he's got to go back and cycle through a couple of more, three or four more times before he's ready to give you that final vision of the New Jerusalem. But I admit that that makes this cycle of seven seals fairly complicated to understand that we've got the second coming already in the sixth seal. Let's see. Do we have any questions about this area of these four different schools or approaches to interpretation? All or nearly all. Now, there are some modernists, that is, people who do not believe that the Bible is actually God's word to us. All right? And they will say, well, it was only about John's own time, and even they will claim he made some mistakes in prophecy. But people who believe the Bible, who have a high view of the Bible's authority, will take the view that it was occupied primarily with this. But most of them will say, when you come to chapter 19, the rider on the white horse, Christ appearing from heaven, that is the second coming. But that up to that point, everything else is related simply to the Roman Empire. So that will be the approach taken by Bible-believing Christians who are interpreting in the Roman Empire point of view.
Well, they
take them as pictures of afflictions that came on the Roman Empire. I mean, there were famines and wars and deaths in the Roman Empire, but of course it didn't take literally the form that some of the plagues are pictured as taking. But you see, then you get into the question: Is the book of Revelation as a whole intended to be read as a newspaper type account, or is it more like a political cartoon where you don't expect to see a literal elephant there out on the street tomorrow because you saw the elephant in a political cartoon? So the people who are in this position will say it's like the political cartoon. It's not, it was understood in that day as not being literal, okay? Well, we've been nearly a full hour now. I think we ought to be dismissed. If some of you have further questions you want to pose afterwards, that's fine. Let's be dismissed in a word of prayer.
The sixth lecture in this series is The Dragon and the Beast from Revelation 12 and 13.
Now, to show you where we are in our discussion, we did take a look in the past 2 weeks at the structure of the book of Revelation as a whole. That was 2 weeks ago. And that it is a symphony. It is really, there are themes that crop up again and again, and there is a rich and very well-organized structure once you begin to look at the book of Revelation carefully. And then the last week we talked about interpreting the book and the fact that the symbols of the book of Revelation are multifaceted. They're like a jewel, and that has provided some of the difficulties which have led to differences in interpretation. But I think we can use that positively to say that those symbols are capable of a multitude of applications to our lives and of having a richness to them precisely because of that. Now, this week is going to be the first of 2 weeks where we'll be looking at the dragon and the beast. And that deviates a little from your schedule because the flyer or the outline has it that next week is going to be the millennium, and that's not quite true. I'm going to postpone the discussion of millennium, primarily at least, to the final week of our time together. But this week we'll be looking at the dragon and the beast, and our main point is going to be to understand what God is saying about his opponents, what he's saying about Satan, the dragon, what he's saying about this figure, the beast, and that God's opponents exist only by counterfeiting him. So that's the general summary. But now I want us to open our Bibles to the book of Revelation, and we will look at what the central part of the book of Revelation, which unfolds to us what God wants us to understand about his opponents. Now, that central part begins at Revelation 12, but it will help if we remember what sort of context in the book these chapters are set. In Revelation 4 and 5, you had a vision of God on his throne. And that's very important to understand that we're dealing with God who is in control of history from the beginning to the end. And that Satan's opposition does not
threaten our ability to say that God is in control of the universe, that we're given a vision of that control tower behind the scenes to understand that. That's chapters 4 and 5. And then after that comes seven successive cycles showing the judgments, different aspects of the judgments God is bringing on the world, leading up to the second coming of Christ. The first of these consists of the opening of seven seals by the Lamb. So again, God is in control. Specifically, the Lamb is in control. And that is, as it were, is God sending out the scouts of his army. In this case, it's angelic beings that go forth under his command to wage war on the earth which is in rebellion against him. He sends out his scouts as they sent out those spies to spy out Jericho. And then the second cycle is seven trumpets. That begins in chapter 8. And that is parallel, you might say, to the people marching around the city of Jericho blowing the trumpets. And I think that's a deliberate parallel in the book of Revelation. So there's seven trumpets there for corresponding to the 7 days that the people walked around the city of Jericho. And all this is saying you and I are in the midst of a spiritual battle. The enemies are no longer visible with the physical eye like those of Jericho were, but they're just as real, and you might say they're more ultimate enemies. Now, the third cycle of judgment begins with chapter 12. All right, the second one was from chapters 8 to chapter 11, and that's the seven trumpets. The third one begins with chapter 12, goes over to chapter 14, leading up again to the second coming. And this these chapters, what happens is that, as it were, the rug of the universe is lifted up, and you see underneath all the dirt that's been swept under the rug, if you will, you see the corruption underlying what is going on the surface of this city of Jericho, if you will, which the earth has become. So chapters 12 and 14 are especially important because they get underneath the surface, because they're meant to open our eyes to see the true dimensions of this spiritual conflict. All right? Now let's begin reading with chapter 12, verse 1. Now we're going to read a fairly long section. I'm going to have only a few comments until we get to the point where we meet the beast. But I want you to be patient so we get a larger picture of what God is revealing about his opponents. Chapter 12, then, verse 1. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with a moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. Who is this woman? Well, I don't want us to spend much time here, but I believe it is the people of God, represents the people of God, both Old and New Testament people of God, ultimately. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. Now this is Satan, as we'll later find out. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. So he's attacking, as it were, heaven itself. He's after usurping the throne of God. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The child, of course, is Jesus Christ himself, who was born as an Israelite coming out of that Old Testament people of God. The woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. The woman is now to be protected by God. Verse 7, and there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom."